Die Presse.
Dieser Podcast wird unterstützt von Erste Group und Vienna Insurance Group.
Jetzt wieder von Anfang an.
Die beste Aufnahme jetzt, ne? Jetzt reißen wir uns zusammen, da. Rote Lämpchen leuchtet.
Hallo Thomas.
Servus Martina.
Wie legen wir das heute an?
Ja, also wir blicken diesmal nach Tschechien und nach Rumänien.
Gut, dann machen wir das so. Ja. Hallo und herzlich willkommen auch Ihnen zu unserem Podcast Eastside Stories. Wir sind Martina Czarnowska
und Thomas Seifert. Unser Gesprächsgast ist die neue rumänische Außenministerin Oana Silvia Toiu. Sie ist eine Politikerin der Unia Salvati Romania, USR, einer liberalen Partei.
Rumänien hat ja turbulente Wahlmonate hinter sich. Wie wir wissen, hat die Präsidentenkür mehrere Anläufe gebraucht. Und auch die Regierungsbildung zog sich hin, denn die Parlamentswahl fand ja schon im Dezember statt. Und dabei ist die politische Mitte zersplittert und die extreme Rechte gestärkt worden. Daher konnte erst vor einigen Wochen eine breite Koalitionsregierung gebildet werden.
Ja, und auch in unserem Nachbarland könnte es dauern, bis eine neue Regierung gebildet wird.
Stimmt, in Tschechien wird am 3. und 4. Oktober ein neues Parlament gewählt.
Ja, und aus Prag erreicht uns auch unsere heutige Voice-Message. Sie kommt von Adela Jurečková. Sie ist die Leiterin der den deutschen Grünen nahestehenden Heinrich-Böll-Stiftung in Prag.
Voice Message. WhatsApp Prag.
Dobrý den, srdečně vás zdravím z Prahy. In Prag und in Tschechien ist jetzt einiges los und die Stimmung ist aufgeheizt in Erwartung von den Parlamentswahlen, die Anfang Oktober stattfinden werden. Und es zeichnet sich schon ab, dass der klare Wahlsieger Andrej Babiš, der ehemalige Premierminister, aber auch Agrarunternehmer, Oligarch, könnte man sagen, wieder Premierminister sein wird. Und da könnte man schon sagen, das ja, ist eine kleine Katastrophe, die auf Tschechien zusteuert. Aber eigentlich die größere wäre, wenn einer seiner Koalitionspartner von der radikalen Rechten oder der radikalen Linken, beziehungsweise es ist ein bisschen schwer zu beschreiben, diese politische Kraft, die eigentlich eher nationalkonservativ ist, aber mit Elementen linker Politik. Also das sind zwei mögliche Koalitionsoptionen für Andrej Babiš und beide würden heißen für Tschechien, dass es eine Abkehr zum gewissen Grad zumindest von der EU und von der NATO geben könnte. Beide Parteien fordern ein Referendum über den Ausstieg aus der EU und aus der NATO. Und das ist natürlich, für Tschechien wäre das fatal, für Europa wäre das fatal, aber auch für die Ukraine wäre diese Option fatal, weil auch beide Parteien fordern, dass man die Ukraine aufhört zu unterstützen oder viel weniger unterstützt. Andrej Babiš selbst positioniert sich da etwas ambivalent, was das angeht. Und ja, wir werden sehen, wie das ausgeht. Es gibt auch noch andere Optionen, aber die aktuelle Regierungskoalition wird leider die Unterstützung wahrscheinlich nicht mehr bekommen und wird nicht mehr im Amt bleiben können. Grund dafür sind, denke ich, vor allem steigende Lebenshaltungskosten. Gerade in Prag sind die Mieten exorbitant hoch. Prag ist eines der teuersten Städte in Europa, was das Wohnen angeht. Und es gab sehr hohe Inflation. Die Preise sind stark gestiegen. Die Löhne, vor allem die Reallöhne, sind eben nicht so stark angestiegen. Und die Menschen sind sauer, sie erwarten Lösungen von der Politik und diese Lösungen haben sie nicht zu einem ausreichenden Ausmaß von der jetzt sich bald verabschiedenden Regierung bekommen.
Das war also Adela Jurečková aus Prag mit ihrer Analyse der Vorwahlsituation in Tschechien.
Wusstest du übrigens, dass die Tschechen erstmals per Briefwahl abstimmen konnten?
Nein, das wusste ich nicht.
Aber anscheinend war das Interesse nicht besonders hoch, denn nicht einmal 30.000 Wähler haben sich für die Briefwahl registriert.
Okay, na, da wird aber die Wahlbeteiligung insgesamt dann ganz interessant werden.
Wird sie.
Ja, aber jetzt schauen wir nach Rumänien und in seine Nachbarländer. Ich wollte nämlich von Außenministerin Oana Silvia Toiu wissen, wohin sie zuletzt gereist ist. Und sie hat von einem Besuch in Kiew berichtet und daher habe ich sie dann gefragt: What did you bring from Kiev in your memory, in your what emotions did you bring home from your trip?
So our countries have gained independence similarly at the same time. And in that sense, it's very interesting to see the evolutions that we each have had. And personally, because I have had great conversations with my good friend, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Andrzej Biga. We've met with President Zelensky, obviously, the new prime minister, that's also my generation, the leadership of the parliament, and the regional leaders. And why I'm mentioning this entire list, is because all of them seemed incredibly perseverant in what they want, very ready to continue to fight for their independence, their people, their family, the children of their nation, but also in the same time, very willing to sit down at the negotiation table, reach a ceasefire, go forward with the peace negotiations. So I really think they are the wise nation in the room currently, because they are ready for both alternatives. The courage to fight for their independence, their people, the lives of their citizens, but also the wisdom to sit at the negotiation table and figure out solutions for a ceasefire and the peace going forward. So I think we all need to understand that now we need extra pressure on Putin.
Mm.
Because we do not see the concessions or the actions needed on their side to show that they're really willing to sit at the negotiation table, that they're really willing to go forward towards a peace. And I think it would be a mistake to decrease the pressure that the United States or the European Union or other international partners are willing to put financially on Russia.
Do you think that there is a chance for peace?
I think peace needs to be our purpose, yes. And I think there is a chance for peace. And I think everything that we're doing needs to be in that direction.
Let's go back a little bit in time. And you had a rough patch in interior politics. And can you walk me through what happened with your presidential elections?
Yes, I think we have been in the attention of the world for that period of time. And something that comes out as lessons from Romania is that at the end of the day, you need your citizens to be resilient. You need your society to be resilient. You cannot fight back interferences or malign narratives if you do not have society citizens on your side. And this has been the case in Romania. And President Nicu Jordan has said this in his first speech in parliament and has often said this. I've heard him say this in the Hague summit as well, that Romania's path has been protected and has been decided by its citizens. And it's so clear that we protect the European path and we protect it with democratic instruments. And one reason why I think this is the case is that we have seen, since we joined the European Union, very clear advances in our quality of life, in our infrastructure, and the society has awarded that with a very clear pro-European vote.
But also what we see is when we look at the election results, there was, I think, clear picture that, of course, the more urban area was, then the more it's kind of pro-European. It goes for pro-European candidates, both, I think, in parliamentary, also in presidential elections. So I'm wondering, have we maybe missed something? Is there something in Europe in general? Because I think it's the same in Germany, in Austria, in France, that this rural-urban divide that is getting more and more, how should I say, acute. What can you do? Does Romania have an answer for that?
I think this is exactly the question, in the sense of what do we do to be better in the way we talk to our citizens? What do we do to be better, not in just how we talk to them, but how we understand their needs, how we understand their fears and their anxiety, and how do we answer to them? In the analysis that we have made, we can see it's not just urban-rural, but rather where have we been better in investing in education? Where have we been better in making sure we have community spaces? For example, the library in the village or the city. Where do people talk to each other face-to-face in spaces that are curated for a proper constructive conversation rather than just be prisoners of the online space, where unfortunately we see also the algorithms push more anxiety, push more negativity. I'm not saying that everything is perfect. I come as a former opposition member of parliament. So that has not transformed me now into a minister that says our country is perfect in every way. In democracy, having critical citizens is a necessity, especially for countries in transition. But there's a difference between legitimate criticism, legitimate expectations from your institutions, and what we have seen in Romania, what we're seeing now in Moldova, for example, which is organized networks of online profiles with the purpose of putting forward malign narratives that try to undermine the European project.
And already you spoke about Moldova. Let's get back to that in a second. But let's stick with the Romanian example for a minute. So what is the lessons that you would have for the rest of Europe where you say, well, you mentioned the civil society was sprung into action, but how... What was this? What is the secret, so to speak? What can we learn from you? Because who knows? Maybe the next elections, we face another problem in Austria, in Germany, wherever, you know?
I think it's most likely to happen, in a sense. So I think one of the lessons, yes, as you've mentioned, is civil society and having a multidimensional dialogue. And I think even Albach Forum, for example, is a great example of having representation here of many generations, many fields of work, because we all need to understand that democracy is not just the project of the institutions or just the citizens. The businesses depend on the fact that democracies work. Everything in our quality of life in terms of freedom, prosperity, depends on protecting this way of life of European values and functioning democracies. So that's one thing, having everyone involved. We wouldn't have made it in Romania, I think, if the business or the artists or the involved young people would have said, not my problem, not my game. I'm just potentially going to go vote, but I'm not going to do anything else. The way we have managed to keep our European path is because everyone that believed in that path, or most of the people that believed in that path, have stepped up, having conversations with others around them, their neighbors, their colleagues. So that is one important lesson. The other is that we need to recognize that the challenges that we have are not just national. We feel them in our national level, sometimes even in local politics, maybe, but they are patterns that repeat themselves. Mm. So we need to understand that if we see patterns that are similar in many countries, then it's not into our advantage that we just reply to them at our national level.
And let's move a little bit out from Romanian internal politics to the European level and the security space.
Yeah.
And I should maybe to our listeners and viewers say, well, Romania is on the front line on several levels. First of all, Romania is, we need to check the map, is on the Black Sea. So number one. Number two, Moldova is your neighbor. As you said, we have strong historical ties. A lot of people speak Romanian. Most people speak Romanian in Moldova. So actually, a lot of Moldovans have Romanian passports.
And therefore, are European Union citizens. Because we need to understand that Moldova potentially is the country that plans to join the European Union.
It
that is mostly
joined.
Integrated already.
It has
the
already
European
joined.
Union.
A lot of citizens have, on the individual level, joined European Union by becoming Romanian citizens, right? So that is another. And the third is also one of the biggest investment of NATO at the moment is a base, an air base, that is in Romania. And of course, this, as I understand it, this flank is very, very, very important because, again, there's also Ukraine in the neighborhood. So there we go. How do you see the security space for Romania with these different threats that you face and what to do about it?
Romania has been for a long time an advocate in international spaces that we all understand that the Black Sea is essential. And in that sense, we see some positive evolutions, not just from NATO, that again, for a long time has recognized this, but also at the European Union level, we now have a strategic approach to the Black Sea. And this is going to be one of the main topics of focus for the next meeting of the ministers of foreign affairs across the European Union. And I think this is very important also if we connect it with the Danube. First of all, it's important commercially. And I think we can do more with the Danube together. Then if you look at the connection Danube-Black Sea, obviously we need to be mindful of the absolute spectacular area that we have in the Danube Delta. And this is something very important for Romania to protect while we advance with the commercial routes, while we advance with the security in the area. We need to remind ourselves that it is a jewelry there that we all need to protect in terms of nature. But the Black Sea in itself is an absolutely strategic project for everyone. What we're doing now is that we're doing demining operations, and we do that in international collaborations, currently with Bulgaria and Turkey, but we are expanding international collaborations on how we work on the Black Sea. We have seen that the Constanța Harbor and the Black Sea have been absolutely essential on the solidarity lanes, but also the way the cereals have been able to travel from Ukraine where other logistical routes have been halted. So we see the Constanța Harbor, but also the Danube and the logistical points there, absolutely essential in the reconstruction project as well. And I've been to Kyiv in the last days. And this is something that the Ukrainian side is also very clear on, the strategic role of the Black Sea, the strategic role of the Danube. And then something coming back to our Romanian-Austrian partnerships, something that is very important in the Black Sea is the source of energy that the Black Sea is. Romania is currently the largest natural gas provider of the European Union.
And the OMV is a partner in the exploration and development of that, yeah.
If we keep the track of what we have planned and keep this as a priority, by the end of 2027, we are going to be able to double the resources that are available not just for Romania in terms of energy, but for the region. And first of all, this is essentially economically. The competitiveness of our companies depends on the cost of energy, access to energy and cost of energy. So I think that is something extremely important for the competitiveness of our companies and of the companies in the region. That's one thing. But also we have seen in the last years how important it is that you have alternatives to be able, if you decide this as a country, to generate autonomy from the energy provided by the Russian Federation. And I think this choice needs to be available and affordable to all countries if we are to keep this strategic autonomy in place. And in that sense, the Black Sea project is also very important. We have recently joined a statement initiated by the United States. It was part of the conversation I had with Marco Rubio as well, where Romania has joined the effort of having common standards on the undersea cables. Because I think we're going to see more of that being needed to connect the region.
Again, talking about the neighbors, how concerned are you when it comes to Moldova? Elections are coming up. We see the same patterns. The shore party is active, etc. So what do you think? What will happen in this regard when it comes to the stability of Romania? Of Moldova, sorry.
I think, no, but you've said it right in the sense where the stability of Moldova has an impact on the EU path of Moldova, but also for anyone that looks closely on the map, and even in the Oval Office, this was clear in terms of the map there, that even the accession of Ukraine to the European Union depends on the accession of Moldova in the sense of the territory and how it is placed. So they have elections on the 28th of September, and I think it is very clear for everyone that the Moldavian citizens have decided on a European path. They have had a referendum when they were clear on this decision. Then they have elected Maia Sandu twice, and Maia Sandu is an amazing country president, very clear on the European path. There is no question there. So I think the Moldavian citizens have already decided on this path. What we need to be aware now with the elections on the 28th is that the free decision of Moldavian citizens is protected. What do I mean by that? Is that the authorities there have discovered in previous elections, including direct bribery with cash money.
Yes.
So that is a threat to any democracy. Then we have overlapping that, what is happening in the online space, for example. And here it is important that we have presence on the ground in terms of European leadership that signals very clearly the support for the European path.
An dieser Stelle unterbrechen wir das Gespräch kurz und zwar für eine Werbeeinschaltung in eigener Sache. Soeben erschienen ist nämlich die aktuelle Ausgabe des Magazins European Voices und gewidmet ist sie dem Donauraum.
Ja, und wir folgen dem Strom, der Europas flüssige Grenze bildet.
Wir haben ein Interview mit Moldawiens Präsidentin Maia Sandu.
Und der Economist-Journalist Richard Cockett fragt, ob Wiens historische Erfolgsformel des Fendisiekla auch heute noch funktioniert.
Wir erfahren auch, wie Wasser und seine Infrastruktur in Konflikten als Waffe eingesetzt werden.
Das Heft kartiert eine Region im Aufbruch zwischen alter Teilung und neuer europäischer Integration.
Schön gesagt. Doch nun kehren wir wieder zurück zu unserem Gespräch mit Rumäniens Außenministerin.
Your neighborhood, things are not easy. You mentioned about the challenge, security challenge mainly from Moldova. And of course Transnistria, as you said, is still an open question. And the other issue is Hungary. And we have Hungarian minority in Romania, and sometimes when he sees fit, Viktor Orban is trying to, you know, mobilize them for his own means. So how is your relationship with Hungary? With Orban is always difficult. I think also even for Austria is difficult. So how to deal with this very important neighbor?
Okay, so first of all, we have this very powerful relationship between the countries in the sense where we have Hungarian minority that is also in the governing coalition. now. So in the sense of what is my relationship to them is that we govern together in Romania with the representatives of the Hungarian minority. And they are very important to us. And I don't mean just by political representation, but if we look at what's happening in the region and in Transylvania, we see that it is actually a space where multiculturalism is celebrated, where most of the times we see a great collaboration there between different cultures. And it is sometimes exploited with small conflicts on the national scene. But I have been to those communities and it is quite clear that that is a space where we prove together that diversity matters and it's celebrated in Romania. We are also one of the, I would say, best international examples in terms of political representation because we have in our constitution the right that each national minority has a representation in parliament. And that is also something very important for us. This being said, we do not agree with Viktor Orban on many of his positions. We are strong supporters of the EU accession of Moldova and Ukraine, and we do not support his position on this. And we also think we need solutions to move forward. And this is something very important. We have the economic integration in the sense of we increase our commercial lines because it's very important now that our economy grows. And obviously, it's important that it grows together with our neighbors. In the same time, I think it's obvious now for anyone that looks at the numbers that Hungary could be better in terms of a lot of the indicators if they would decide to come closer to our common European Union decisions. So I think that that is something that has become increasingly clear in terms of numbers. Romania, in that sense, has always been a strong EU supporter. Our position from day one was to have a stronger European Union, to do more together. And I think our position has been clearly beneficial in terms of numbers. So we have increased our GDP since we joined the European Union 3.5 times. When we joined, the average income per capita was 40% of the EU average. Mm. Now it's 80% of the EU average. I'm not saying European Union is a perfect project. Mm. We need to be better even ourselves as negotiators on common European Union decisions. But I'm saying staying the European Union path, advocating for a stronger Europe, has paid off for Romania. And I think even now when we look at the security of our region, it matters a lot that we do that together with our transatlantic partner. The presence of the United States in the NATO bases is very important for us, but also together with our European partners. And for a long time, there has been a conversation of what is the right choice, be closer to the United States or be closer with the European Union. But I think now even the negotiations in Washington have proved that actually the choice needs to be a stronger US-EU partnership. Mm. And I think Romania is in a good position to support that because we have a strong partnership, strategic partnership with the United States, and in the same time have always been at the core of the group of countries that support a more integrated European Union.
Talking about what the EU must do when it comes to your region, I took a train last year from Bucharest to Sofia, the train.
Yeah.
And it's horrible.
We need to be better at that.
It needs much better. And of course, this is not only Romania's or Bulgaria's issue. It's something where we talk a lot about trans-European networks and developing our railroad systems, et cetera, et cetera. So there is infrastructure issues where, of course, I think it's not only in Romania's interest because if it's great for Austria's economy, if we have great railroad connectivity, it's great for Germany, for everybody. You know, so we need to connect Europe. What do you think needs to be done? Because it seems to be a little bit that your area has been forgotten a little bit, hasn't it?
I also have a personal stake here in the sense that first time that I got out of the country was by train to Vienna.
Yeah.
So, and this was 20 years ago.
Not much has improved. Huh?
So I can compare personally quite clearly this. So I think, first of all, we need more investments in this area. And if we speak more about being climate neutral, being climate friendly, being carbon neutral, I think that doesn't need to be just extra taxes on the cars that are polluting. This needs to be massive investments in the alternative. And I think train is a spectacular alternative to that. It's a spectacular alternative, not just in the sense of climate change, but also it's safer because we have a lot of accidents on the roads and the train is safer. It's also more predictable if you do it right for the businesses. Yeah. And I think it can also be essential for the massive flow of resources that we're going to need for the common reconstruction project of Ukraine. So in that sense, on our side, we need to keep the priority on investments and we need some reforms there. This new government that we're having for 50 days now is a government with the Prime Minister, Mr. Ilie Bolojan, set on the needed reforms. Because in some cases, we need institutional reforms or state company reforms, as it is with the railway, that will enable us to be the ones that use the funding available to make it more proper to 2025, in the sense of the quality standards, the speed, the changes that need to happen in our railway system.
So one is infrastructure. And of course, we can always joke that I think, what is it, like only two bridges across the Danube between Bulgaria and Romania?
We need more, yes.
And I think it's seven or something like that in Vienna alone. So we see that there is a huge need and catch up. And the other thing is, and of course, I'm interested in your opinion, it seems to be a little bit also that Western Balkans integration has been a little bit back on the back burner. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we focus on Ukraine, clearly. We need to focus on Moldova, clearly. But also when we look at the region, some countries are waiting. When I think, I don't know, Edi Rama in Albania, they're really waiting. Montenegro, they have even their euro. Yeah. They're waiting. And of course, we see with Serbia. So we have to be, on the one hand, we have to be careful not to be too fast. And on the other hand, well, we can't keep them in the waiting room all the time.
I'm just partially agreeing with what you're saying. Sure. In the sense where I think the European Union has been delaying that way before we had the focus on Ukraine and Moldova.
You're right.
So I wouldn't necessarily create the relationship between the two in the sense where we were behind as a European Union on the process of supporting these countries of joining the European Union way before we had the focus on Ukraine and Moldova. What is happening now, though, is that we see a moment in time where the EU enlargement has gained momentum again. And yes, that is because of Ukraine and Moldova as well. But I think that can be beneficial for the Western Balkans in the sense in which the whole decision of EU enlargement now is in a better place than it has been 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. So I understand personally a bit if you're a citizen of these countries and you know you're waiting for a long time that you see maybe other countries at a faster pace being integrated. So I see this personal perspective.
EU seems to be like Godot for these people.
I see this personal perspective that becomes a social and political perspective. But in the same time, maybe these 3, 4 years have been the catalyst needed to put the EU enlargement decision again at the core of what we want as a European Union. And I think that is going to be beneficial for the Western Balkans as well.
We need to come to a close with this interview, but I have two questions for you. One is, what is like your personal European dream? Are you waiting for Romania joining the euro? Bulgaria, they're talking about it. What is it that you think that what is still missing in your personal Romanian European dream?
I would want Romania to have the president of the European Commission soon, but giving the...
Are you a contender for that?
No, I'm the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and I think Romania needs that now that we have an integrated team at home. And also we have great teams of European Parliament members and a great commissioner. I'm not speaking about the current moment, but I'm speaking about the fact that the European Union is going to benefit from a stronger Eastern voice. Not just from Romania, but the whole region, I think, is very important, not just in the lessons learned, but in the way we see the European Union going forward. And I think we're closer to a moment where we have more balanced representation, not just in the way we vote, because that is already quite clearly said. We're the sixth country in terms of number of citizens and therefore representation, but in the way the conversations are being influenced, the way the conversations are being shaped, I think it's a moment where not just Romania, but us in the region become more proactive in having our own proposals rather than the instinct of alignment that we have had throughout the years.
And I have usually two traditional questions. One question is, what is one or more books or podcasts or Netflix or anything that you would recommend for our listeners and viewers?
So I'm a big fan of the Friends of Europe podcasts because they tend to be very inclusive with alternative voices, artists, but also politicians and mainstream proposals. And I think at the core of those conversations is the idea of making sure that our social contract within the European Union becomes stronger. And I think that is the underlying task of all the other fields of work, be it business or security or democracy.
So after listening to our podcast, switch over to the Friends of Europe podcast.
Definitely your podcast first, because this is...
No, absolutely. No, I think we are all on the same page here.
Den Link zu unserem Gespräch mit Außenministerin Toyu finden Sie in den Shownotes, sowie auch alle Informationen zur neuen Ausgabe der European Voices unter europeanvoices.eu.
Ja, und das war Kapitel 5 unserer Eastside Stories. Jeden letzten Donnerstag im Monat erscheint eine neue Podcast-Folge.
Danke, dass Sie dabei waren. Hören Sie uns wieder.
Servus.
До свидания.